Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Our beloved First Amendment. Let me read that again. Congress shall make no law, respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Wonderful, isn't it? Our basic freedoms. So reads one of the most powerful statements ever made by any group of thinkers, the founding fathers of this great country, as they fashioned the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States in the year 1791. Congress shall make no law. None. None whatsoever. No law. So reads the amendment. And that is so very important because the First Amendment applies only to the Congress of the United States and not the respective states of the United States then existing or as later admitted to the Union. States, 2 centuries ago, were therefore free to treat religion as they would and were not prevented by the First Amendment from even establishing a state religion if the citizens so chose. Interesting distinction, don't you think? Wonder why they did it that way. Congress, says the First Amendment, emphatically so, shall make no law, none whatsoever, none of any kind. I need to repeat that over and over again because they're starting to do it, especially one which would abridge the freedom of speech or of the press. So then the prohibition to Congress included not only making no law, any law which affected the freedom of speech, but also preventing Congress from doing even indirectly what it could not legally do directly. That is, in any way amending or prohibiting, abridging the freedom of speech. Can't do anything, Congress. No words of any kind can be forbidden or abridged. None. None. Interestingly, the concept of freedom of speech was a right of early American legislators. Very interesting. To be used by legislators in critical ways against the British and the King. But by 1776, Americans were treating freedom of speech as a right of citizens against the government in general, and not only for legislators. The prohibition against Congress in the First Amendment was interpreted by the courts to mean that there could be no prior restraint. No prior restraint of any kind. But from that time forward, there was every attempt by Congress, even the President, to whittle away the concept of unbridled freedom of speech. I don't know why. So that when words were uttered, those words could and often did produce consequences, both legal and personal. Well, perhaps that's reasonable. What do you think? Courts determined through legal interpretation that if words produced actions or deeds which resulted in dire consequences, that is, harm to another, legal remedies applied. That sounds reasonable, does it not? Again, what do you think? Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, one famous Supreme Court justice, indicated in essence that there were words which were not constitutionally protected. Interesting, isn't it? Such as shouting fire in a theater. Okay. Fire in a theater when there was none. Justice Holmes' exact words were as follows. The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. Huh. Okay. That sounds like it might be a reasonable restraint on the First Amendment and freedom of speech. What do you think? In other words, if words uttered without prior restraint falsely produced a panic, the speaker could be held liable for any consequent damages causally related to those words. In further qualifying or perhaps even abridging the right of free speech, Justice Holmes went on to state the following. The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such nature as to create a clear and present danger. A clear and present danger. That they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. Wow, that's quite a statement, isn't it? If, therefore, said Justice Holmes, words produce a clear and present danger, and that leads me to ask what would be a clear and present danger, and those words as uttered bring about substantive evils, Okay, substantive evils, well, how do you define that? If that in fact does happen, Congress, says Justice Holmes, does have a right to prevent that. Of course, those words and the Holmes opinions were soundly challenged, but nonetheless, it became law. It became legal precedent, and many think allowed Congress to either violate or ignore the express prohibition of the First Amendment, making qualifying legislation when they are prohibited from doing any or abridging, qualifying, or interpreting words that are in fact free speech. Well, so begins the whittling away. Fascinating indeed, is it not? How Congress and the courts can interpret away the clear and exact words of a fundamental and powerful amendment. If words have consequences, and if they present a clear and present danger under the circumstances, and if those words produce substantive evils, whatever they are, Congress can regulate such words and provide legal, financial, and even penal consequences to them. Wonder what the Founding Fathers would have said about that. The courts then created a right in Congress, not existing in the Constitution, to interpret and even prohibit free speech and the expression thereof if the time and the manner and the place in which the speech was uttered clearly indicated those words would produce dire consequences. Substantive evils. In short, whenever Congress decided that words were substantive evil producing, those words could be regulated, even prohibited. That, my fellow Americans, is abridging and even eviscerating the clear wording and intention of the First Amendment, don't you think? Or do you? Fast forward 225 years. The First Amendment and freedom of speech become even more fragile. Now comes this thing called hate speech, however that is defined. Presumably, if the hearer of words determines in an individual way that the speaker of the words was hateful or intended the words with hate in the heart, those words could produce harm to the hearer and consequently could have legal consequences. As an example, if one dared to say that marriage was a union between a man and a woman, LGBT could be offended, declare the statement hate speech, and go after the speaker and his speech. That is so legally, whether civil or even criminal. In that regard, there came an excellent article in Decision Magazine published by the Billy Graham Organization entitled The Culture of Offendedness. The Culture of Offendedness. The author of the article that I refer to, Mr. Moeller, asks this question. Is there such a thing as the right not to be offended? Did you get that? Is there such a thing as the constitutional right not to be offended? If one, for example, spoke against abortion, which in turn brought down the wrath of feminist and women's rights groups, would such groups have the right to legal action, declaring anything said negatively about abortion as hateful and consequently offensive? So they sue, or they blacklist, or they turn to Congress to declare that such words do in fact produce, those words again, substantive evils. A blatant and hateful attack on women's rights, which is offensive. It activates offendedness. It's unbelievable, isn't it? The words have aroused an emotional state in the hearer, which then results in some real or perceived insult to their belief system, whether or not such a state of offendedness results in any real harm. It is the end result of having been offended, which itself is the substantive evil. You hurt my feelings. I will therefore come after you. Doesn't that sound like a lot of what's going on in America today? What an abridging of free speech. Historically, offendedness resulted only when there were very serious matters at work, such as causing the hearer to be brought down or even to be crushed. But today, desperate straits are no longer required for an individual or group to claim the emotional status of offendedness. All that is required, says Moeller, is often the vaguest notion of emotional distaste at what another has said, or done, or proposed, or presented. In short, my fellow Americans, there now comes in our culture a demand for a new right, and that is the right never to be offended. Unbelievable. no matter that there is absolutely no constitutional basis for such a right, but it seems as though more of our citizens in our culture actually accept such a right as legitimate, whether constitutional or not. That is especially so when such a concept is promoted by the media and by government and by activist groups. The distinguished Christian philosopher Paul Helms argues that the social value of offendedness is now increasing. Helms states the following: "All that is necessary for a claim to be taken seriously is for the claim to be offered. You hurt my feelings. You activated an emotional, hurtful state in me, and therefore I am offended." Such a reaction, says Helms, can do nothing but deeply fracture our society and turn one citizen against another, not to mention the absolute stifling of free speech and freedom of opinion. Ah, what a sad day for America. And then Mr. Mueller states the following: "The risk of being offended is simply part of what it means to live in a diverse culture that honors and celebrates free speech." Amen to that. In short, to live in a free society with free speech carries risk. Risk for all. That is the risk of being offended. I am offended by pornography, but it exists whether I like it or not. I am offended by magazines like Hustler and Playboy, but they exist under the protection of the First Amendment whether I like it or not. I may be offended by these publications, but I have no right to legal action as a result of my being offended as a result of what is published in these magazines. There are those now who are deeply offended by Christianity, radical secularists who do everything in their power to stifle or eliminate free speech when the content thereof is Christian. The need of a man or woman for a Christian experience, so testifies the Christian, can be viewed as hateful, for it implies that the need for that experience, that Christian experience, it implies that the one who needs it is sinful, sinful in conduct, which makes the speech hate speech, harmful and offensive to the hearer. Freedom of religion under the First Amendment and the exercise thereof, including speech and witness as a part of that exercise, and more of the First Amendment comes into play with the attempt to eliminate or at least abridge the right of religious free speech. Don't you see that happening, as I do? You may be entitled to believe what you wish, but you are not, say these angry secularists, entitled to verbalize those beliefs in the form of witness or testimony for fear of causing offendedness in the hearer. That sentiment, that prohibition, is growing rapidly in our even more rapidly growing secularized culture. And the fracturing of our society in terms of dialogue, as Helms has indicated, heightens every day. We don't talk, we don't discuss, we argue and we condemn. Mr. Mueller goes on to say the following: "A right to free speech means a right to offend." I like that. A right to free speech means a right to offend. That it does indeed. In short, the right to offend is inherent in free speech on the part of the speaker. The risk of being offended by the hearer is the counterpart to that equation, so that if one chooses to listen, that listener runs the risk of being offended. And that is precisely what the First Amendment means and attempts to protect as the guardian of free speech. But the secularist persists with aggressive intent, even hatefully so, on pushing this proposed right, the right not to be offended, and especially so with being offended by confrontation with the Christian gospel. It's happening all the time. So aggressive is the cultural war over the First Amendment and Christian witness that Mr. Mueller states as follows: "Christians must understand a particular responsibility to protect free speech and to resist this culture of offendedness that threatens to shut down all public discourse." And indeed it does. One should have the right, the absolute right, to discuss beliefs, values, morality at every turn. And the only right of the listener is not to listen. Not to listen. Not the right not to be offended. Just don't listen.